I'm Natalie Morales of 48 Hours. So much of our reporting focuses on the stories of victims who didn't survive. But what about those who lived to tell?
I survived a violent home invasion. There's no earthly reason why I'm alive.
From 48 Hours, this is It Could Have Been Me.
It makes you grateful for everything you have, you know.
You can follow and listen to It Could Have Been Me on Tuesdays in the 48 Hours podcast feed on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so ESPN does this thing every year where they survey league executives, coaches, and scouts, and they rank the top 10 players at each position. And they tell you who the kind of the first few out are as well, the honorable mentions, also receiving votes, whatever it is you want to call. Every position, 11 position groups, and they roll it out one day at a time over a week and a half. And today is the first day. And the running backs are the first ones up. Before we get to the list and whether or not Joe Mixon made it and if he's represented on here, I think it's safe to say, like, very much so, Seth, so far so good on the Joe Mixon trade. I mean, you got him for nothing. You sent a seventh-round pick because he was going to get cut. You did give him a new deal. He's making $8 or $9 million a year or whatever on a three-year deal. I think so far so good with Mixon.
No,
right?
Yeah, I think, okay, would they have been better served by going after Saquon Barkley or Derrick Henry in free agency? Perhaps, except that neither of those guys would have had the same season in that offense last year. I mean, Joe Mixon, I'd love to be able to play the experiment of, okay, how would Joe Mixon have done in those situations? I'm not saying he would have been as good as those guys.
Like if he's on the Eagles or the Ravens or something.
Yeah, if he actually was a part of a competent offense.
Yes.
So far so good. For giving him the new contract was really the move. The trade was no big deal whatsoever. So you're going to have the same issues you have with any guy that's a running back approaching 30 and who's got a lot of wear off the tires. So you're going to be worried about injuries. That's sort of if you can have Nick Chubb at 85% of his previous version of himself, I like that 1-2 punch.
Yeah, I do too. Joe Mixon is in the top 10, according to this voting. He made it. He is the 9th rated running back. And they basically ask all these executives and coaches and scouts to rank every position their top 10, and then they tabulate it like it's like an MVP balloting or something.
Yeah.
They also tell you on here the highest ranking they got from anybody and the lowest ranking they got from anybody. Lowest ranking, obviously, like there were voters that left Joe Mixon off of their ballot. The highest he was ranked, someone had him 5th as the 5th best running back in football on their balloting.
That would put him in front of Josh Jacobs, who was the actual... Oh, no, Josh Jacobs was 6th. Oh, Christian McCaffrey was 5th.
He was 5th.
Controversial, I'm guessing. Christian McCaffrey had a lowest ranking of unranked as well, and a highest ranking of 3.
Yeah.
McCaffrey's missed 10 or more games in 3 of his past 5 years.
Yeah.
If you can tell me McCaffrey's healthy, I'll take him over just about anybody.
Yep.
But I just don't know with him.
I don't either. Here's what they say about Mixon, because they'll give a couple quotes. Mixon looked rejuvenated in Houston after the Texans acquired him in a trade. He's not a home run hitter with a career average of 4.1 yards per carry over 8 seasons, but he's got just about everything else. An NFL personnel evaluator said, quote, really good vision, really good feet, contact balance, a hammer in the run game.
Hammer.
Looked worn down at the end of the season, but overall was a really good trade for Houston, end quote. Now, keep in mind, he's still got 2 years left on the contract he's got with the Texans. This is me talking now. Do you think maybe that's a reason, Nick Chubb? Like, do you think he looked worn down at the end of the season, Seth? Do you recall how he looked at the end of last year?
Joe Mixon?
Joe Mixon.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember scoring a couple touchdowns in that Chargers playoff win. He looked
pretty
good.
If anything, they started to figure a few things out at the end of the season in the playoffs, where with play selection and the style of running, it made more sense.
Yeah.
So I just, as it was with Bobby Slowick, where even, I think even D'Amico cited, D'Amico talked about the importance of making adjustments throughout the season and in games. He didn't mention Bobby Slowick specifically, but that's where our minds all went.
Sure.
I think that in a lot of ways, it actually started to look and feel better and more dependable towards the end of the year. And yet, that was a guy who voted positively for Mixon, so I'm not going to crush him too hard.
Mixon is the NFL's only player with at least 1,300 scrimmage yards and 9 touchdowns in each of the past 4 seasons.
I do think he's a guy who will age well.
Yeah.
That it's And I know he had his injuries last year. The one with the hip drop tackle, I kind of give him a pass on that because it was just – it was a dirty
– Yeah, he got his
by
ankle
modern,
pinned.
So by
yeah.
the current rule book, not a dirty play, but it was – I mean, it's a play that's banned for a reason.
Yeah.
It hurts guys'
He got
ankles.
Rolled up. Whether it was legal yeah. or illegal, he got his ankle rolled. I can't say he's injury prone because he got his ankle rolled, you know?
Yeah.
I just can't believe that stat I just read. And he's the NFL's – think about the players around the league. Across the board, like receivers and running backs, he's the only player with at least 1,300 scrimmage yards and 9 touchdowns in each of the past 4 seasons across
okay,
the league.
Okay, this is these were his numbers in the last 4 games. We're in the playoffs. The playoffs, the Chargers game especially, I felt pretty good about it.
Yeah.
Last 4 games of the season, including the Tennessee one.
He barely played.
Yeah, 23 yards against the Dolphins, 57 yards against Kansas City, okay. 26 yards against Baltimore.
Okay, okay.
And then 23 yards against Tennessee at the
played
end.
Played long enough to get over 1,000 for the season against Tennessee,
yeah.
like Nico. what about the playoffs? Do you have the 2 playoff games in front
of you? Yeah, playoffs, he had 106 yards against the Chargers and then 88 yards against the Chiefs.
Yeah, I mean, that's to me, like that's 2 really good games against 2 really good teams. With high stakes. So I don't know if I'm as worried about this personnel guy, about the wearing down part. He's also, his 94.6 scrimmage yards per game trails only Arian Foster and DeAndre Hopkins in the history of the Houston Texans. So that's a pretty sporty season, man. Like that's like Andre Johnson is, you know, he was also on the Texans and that Joe Mixon is the, you know, he trails only 1 season of Foster and 2 seasons of Hopkins in Texans history.
I'll tell you what, and the one I didn't even consider him making this top 10 list. The guy that maybe gives you your best hope of like a longer career is Alvin Kamara, who was the 10th just after Mixon, who had over 1,500 scrimmage yards last year. Different type of running back, obviously, is a dual threat type of dude.
Been around, though, like you're saying. He's
right, right, right. Yeah, it's not with running backs. I know the stats, and I know that they drop off precipitously after the age of 27, but there's a big asterisk there in that there are some guys that make their 28, 29, and 30-year-old seasons and on into, like, Derrick Henry's an extreme exception.
Yeah.
Some of the guys do just – they produce better.
Yep.
The averages are what they are, but some guys age better than others. I think Mixon's going to age relatively well.
Yep.
I don't think he's going to necessarily be like Curtis Martin or a Derrick Henry or somebody, but I'm not overly concerned about the next 2 years of aging.
The splits on some of these guys are wild in this voting. And again, if you're just getting in your car, ESPN is doing their annual survey of executives and coaches and scouts ranking the top 10 players at each position. They ask all these voters to give their top 10 at each position, and then they tabulate the votes. Saquon, no surprise, highest ranking 1, lowest ranking 2. So there's not a big gap there. Derrick Henry, highest ranking 1, lowest ranking 6. Okay, I'd like to talk to the guy who put Derrick Henry at 6, but okay. I mean, he was 9th last year in this thing, so.
Son of a, that dude definitely, that's a divisional opponent, I think.
You think?
How do you watch Derrick Henry last year and say that he's not? That guy might have put Christian McCaffrey's 5th on this list. I don't know how that guy voted with Christian McCaffrey, but still.
The spreads between the highest and lowest, though, like Jahmyr Gibbs, highest ranking he got was 2, lowest was 9. That sounds about right. How about Bijan Robinson? Bijan is 4th on this thing. Okay, Bijan, who is toiling in anonymity in Atlanta right now for the most average team you could think of. Like, if you give me a team, I could pick one team to finish 8-9 the next 3 years. I'll take the Atlanta Falcons. They're just like they're the ultimate average team. There is somebody that ranked Bijan Robinson as the best running back in football, and there's other voters that didn't have him in the top 10. Like that's
right.
That is a big split for Bijan Robinson.
He had almost 1,500 yards rushing. The Bijan Robinson last year, because he was misused in his rookie year, and then last year he makes the Pro Bowl, has a nice season, 1,500 yards. Except it's just an indication of how devalued the running back has become in the modern NFL. It used to be if you had a 1,500 yard running back, you're like, boy, all we got to do is fill in the pieces around him, and we're off to the races.
Campbell. Yeah.
Now it's like, Bijan Robinson made the top 10. What the hell?
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah, it's weird. He's 4th. Christian McCaffrey, again, someone voted him 3rd, which when healthy, that might be undershooting it when he's healthy. He's outstanding. And then others had him unranked, didn't put him in the top 10, and I'm guessing that's because of injuries. He was number 1 in this exercise last year because he was coming off a healthy season. Josh Jacobs, Jonathan Taylor is 7th. James Cook is 8th. And then you get Joe Mixon at 9. And as Seth mentioned, Alvin Kamara at 10. So, yeah, Joe Mixon cracking the old top 10. So the Texans are 1-for-1, Seth. This is the first of 11 top 10 lists that ESPN is going to be putting out here.
Defensive tackles is today at some point. I don't think that they'll crack the top 10 there.
I don't even think they'll get an honorable mention there.
No. And I feel better about the group of defensive tackles than I know a lot of our listeners do. But part of that is just because it's roster construction. Yep. They've got studs at the really big money positions. You need solid role players at defensive tackle, at least. And I think they've got a bunch of solid role players. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'd love to have a guy that's a all-pro caliber type dude, but I'm just not – you can still be a really, really good defense with the guys they have.
Okay, Wednesday will be fun. That's edge rusher day with ESPN. Mm-hmm. Do the Texans get 2 in the top 10? Will Anderson Jr. and Danielle Hunter, do they both crack the top 10?
Yeah, I think they'll definitely get – I think they'll both be in the top 10.
They're in the top 10 on the odds board for everything. They're in the top – the Vegas odds makers are Bet Online, whatever the one we get the emails from. They had the odds on who's going to lead the NFL in sacks next year. And Danielle Hunter and Will Anderson are both in the top 10 there. They're both, I think, in the top 10 for Defensive Player of the Year odds board as well, if not top 12 or 13. You don't get past 10 or 12 without seeing both of those guys. Who do you think gets ranked higher by NFL people? Danielle Hunter? If you were putting a top 10 together, if you were an NFL executive, scout, or coach voting in this, who would you have higher? This is not based on the future. The criteria is who is the best right now for 2025. Obviously, if you're factoring in the future, Will Anderson might be at the top of the list given he's going into year 3 of his rookie contract. But if we were just for 2025, if you had to put one ahead of the other, who would it be, Hunter or Will Anderson?
I would put Will Anderson ahead of Danielle Hunter just with run defense being the tiebreaker. Mm-hmm. So I think that Will Anderson – and the completeness of him and what you can do with him. Even though I'd give Danielle Hunter still an edge as the actual pass rusher, I think Will's a little bit more of a complete player right now.
I would add, too, that Danielle Hunter probably is who he is as a pass rusher at age 30 or whatever he is. Will Anderson feels like there's still some room to grow as a pass rusher, and I feel like he puts in the work to – I mean, we saw the jump that he made from his rookie year to his second year. So I agree with you on the run defense part. And I think just on the spec that there is another gear to Will Anderson in the pass rush, whereas Danielle Hunter is already in fifth or sixth gear right now. I'm with you on that. It's close though, man. Like I could see them finishing like 5 and 6 right next to each other.
I think with Danielle too. If I were voting on this, I might, as an anonymous voter, be kind of like, you know what, Danielle Hunter hasn't gotten the credit he deserves over the course of his career.
Oh,
partly because he plays in Minnesota. Yeah. I'm going to vote him up a little bit.
A little lifetime achievement award aspect.
I do. I sense that, and I get it. I'm not criticizing this, but the sense amongst the fan base is I do feel like Will Anderson gets way more of the adulation. Because he's a young guy, because he's a draft pick, because of the manner in which they traded up to get him, and because of his personality.
Big personality is the thing.
Where Danielle Hunter, it feels a little bit like George Springer in Toronto.
Yeah.
Right, where Springer's having a hell of a year yet again. And yet, I felt like when I went to that one Blue Jays playoffs game, and I felt like, okay, they've got all these young guys. Bo Bichette looks like he's 14 years old, very lovable. They were emotionally attached and tied to all those young guys.
It's a really good
analogy. To where the veteran addition, it doesn't get quite as much the embrace.
Will Anderson is Vlad Guerrero Jr.
Right.
That's who he is.
Just with better eating habits.
You got that right.
We've never once had a conversation about whether Will is too fat or not.
Fat, no. Came back big last year, but muscular.
Big, but not fat.
Not fat.
Fat with a PH.
That's right. Thursday, they do the safeties. I don't think the Texans are going to have any safety. Maybe C.J. Gardner-Johnson.
C.J. Gardner-Johnson will be one where he gets definitely a whole bunch of people that have him unranked, but then a few that are like, this guy's underrated. I don't get why they don't. The guy's had, 11 interceptions in the last however many?
13, 13
interceptions in his last two full years. Yeah. He missed most of the, I think C.J. Gardner-Johnson gets some votes.
Yeah, I do too. I do too.
But the dependability part of it is going to be the thing that people are questioning.
Yep. I wonder if Kalen Bullock gets a few votes. Probably a little early to put Kalen Bullock in the top 10. But he's had that direction.
Oh, yeah, 100% too early.
Too early.
Yeah, that's I think, look, because this is what happens this time of year, too. People look at the PFF grades and all that stuff. They're not analyzing safety play for all 32 teams.
No.
And they don't – remember we had that one guy, I think it was Sam Monson from the 33rd team, who talked about how, well, them bringing C.J. Gardner-Johnson in shows that they're trying to keep Kalen Bullock off the field. And everybody – Texans fans are like, what the hell are you talking about? What you don't see in the grades is the improvement along the year and like just how much he advanced from week 1 to week 17.
Dude, we'll get to some outlandish stuff that somebody from PFF was saying about the Texans offensive line yesterday in an article. At least I thought it was outlandish. Friday they're doing tight ends. This is the ESPN top 10 vote by executives, coaches, and scouts. I don't think we'll get any representation in the tight. We can skip over that one.
We don't. I do think that
these next few are going to go very quickly for us.
Yeah, Dalton Schultz might be the guy who's most excited about having a new offensive coordinator.
Yeah.
And also, however much injuries contributed to him having his issues last year.
Yeah.
But I think hopefully Nick Caley won't put Dalton Schultz in as many bad situations in pass protection.
Right.
There were times last year where, and honestly, wasn't even Dalton. The pass protection was so simplistic at times that it looked like Dalton Schultz was getting dusted when it wasn't actually even his responsibility.
Yep.
So the fan vitriol was even higher than it should have been, but he also was put in bad positions where he did fail. I think he'll be better in that regard if Nick Caley's a better offensive player.
Yeah, like I could see like a year from now, I could see Dalton Schultz having had a year where we expect him to be on something. I don't expect him to be in the top 10 on this thing. Interior offensive line, I think we can just say no. Offensive tackles, the thing I'll be interested to see is where Laremy Tunsil falls in with the offensive tackles. I know he's not a Texan anymore, but these are executives and coaches and scouts that are voting on this thing. Is in Laremy Tunsil last year for the offensive tackles, I'm sure was somewhere around 5 or whatever. You know, I'm sure he was in the top 5 or 6. I'm curious if the Texans trading him takes any of the shine off of Laremy Tunsil, like that the Texan solution to trying to fix the worst offensive line in football was trading their best offensive lineman. And so I wonder if that takes any of the shine. I wonder if the extreme number of penalties that he had, like he has penalties all the time. He had an extreme number last year. I'm just curious if he is still viewed as a top 5 tackle in the NFL by higher-ups around the league.
The penalties, this is the problem with the penalties and how people analyze them, is that they don't see it week after week after week the way that we do. And they also don't realize necessarily that, boy, it's not just Laremy Tunsil's penalties, it's when they occur, how often they've happened on critical drives, or when they've driven the team out of field goal position, or all of these things that just doesn't register, so they blow that off. I am going to be interested because the people that want to stick up for Laremy Tunsil and will die on the hill battling it will point out his PFF pass blocking grade and completely ignore his run blocking grade.
Correct.
So if you're going to pray to the PFF gods, I don't know why you're not looking at the overall grade, which has him as the 23rd out of 140 offensive tackles graded.
Yep.
They'll stick to just the pass blocking grade. So I think he'll be a classic guy where he'll be in the top 3. I don't think there will be anybody that will vote him out of the top 10 because the pass blocking is so good and so important. I'd be curious to see when anonymous executives who look at the whole picture more so than people on Twitter look at PFF pass blocking grades.
Yep. Okay, these last 4 are going to be interesting. Thus far, I think the only ones that we think the Texans are going to have a player in the top 10 are the 2 edge rushers, Hunter and Anderson. Does C.J. Stroud make the top 10 at quarterback? That'll be next Monday. They're going to be dropping the top 10 quarterbacks. In the eyes of people around the league, Seth, coaches, scouts, executives, I think C.J. Stroud cracks the top 10. I think those people saw what happened last year as less of a Stroud problem than it was a Slowick and the line problem.
Yeah, I think 100%. I think he makes the top 10. I think you're going to see quotes from, man, If you look beyond the stats and you look at what he was working with and some of the things that he did do and was able to do despite everything going on around him, that people remain impressed with C.J. Stroud. And they're just – everybody right now – and I would include the not just the executives and scouts, but just actual sports writers right now are kind of in a wait-and-see mode on C.J. Stroud. I've seen very few actual thinking people – say, oh, yep, CJ Stroud has been proven to be this or proven to be that in a bad way. They're just kind of waiting and seeing what he does with Nick Caley.
Yeah. I think he'll be, if I had to predict an exact spot, I think he'd be like ninth, somewhere around there.
I still think like most of the people voting on this, I think if they had the choice between Brock Purdy and CJ Stroud, I think would still take CJ Stroud.
I agree. 100%. Agreed. Off-ball linebackers. I don't think the Texans get any in the top 10, but I could see Azeez Al-Shaair getting some votes. You being like an honorable mention kind of guy.
That's
about what I feel on that one.
There's the thing about this defense is it puts a lot of stress on your linebackers. The way they ask the linebackers to play, it makes it hard. So, but if you can do it really, really well, like Fred Warner, you get a chance to really showcase everything. Oh, yeah. Problem is, if you're not great in pass coverage, it shows up in this defense.
Yep.
And the offenses are able to put this defense in a bind, and it's harder to protect your linebackers from that. So that they don't right now have anybody. They don't have a linebacker who's good in pass coverage.
No.
Like, not a single one.
Yeah.
So, like, that's the only thing that I'm really concerned about in this with this defense going
into
this
tight
year.
Ends might still eat against the Texans this year for sure. All right, the last two, and I think the Texans get a guy, at least one in each of these. The wide receivers are dropping. The top 10 vote on wide receivers will drop on July 16th. I think if Nico Collins hadn't gotten hurt last year for five games, I think he's in the top five. I think he will definitely be in the top 10. I haven't seen a top 10 list of wide receivers this offseason that doesn't include Nico Collins, and that's after he missed 5.5 games last year.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's generally talent-wise, I think he is viewed as a definite top 10 wide receiver in the NFL. Do you agree with that?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah.
No, I think a lot of people, I think there's a lot of other, a lot of, kind of in line with CJ Stroud, where with Nico, they're just waiting to see him have a completely healthy season.
Yes.
And they just said that's the huge question mark with him right now. It's like, all right, can you be durable enough to make an entire season?
He's so good, man. He has become so good. And then cornerbacks, I guess the question would be, is Derek Stingley Jr. named the number one cornerback in the NFL by executives, scouts, and coaches in this thing?
I think that especially with executive scouts and coaches, the durability is still going to be a question.
Okay.
So I don't think – I would be surprised if he is.
Top five?
Like just when he's actually playing. He's a little bit in the Christian McCaffrey boat of, man, when he's healthy, yeah, he's incredible.
Yep.
But we've seen one fully healthy season out of him. So I think he's top three.
Top three?
I
think probably
Sertan. I think the only one I wonder about is Sertan, Gardner. I wonder if Gardner finishes as high as he typically has. Jalen Johnson and Trent McDuffie are the other two.
Yep.
I think McDuffie probably. I'm guessing it's going to go Sertan, McDuffie, Stingley.
That's what I was going to say. That's the exact order I was going to put him in. I think that's the order I'm trying to think like you're doing. I'm trying to think like the guys whose titles are voting in this thing. You know, it's not a fan vote. It's not a recency vote. It's not a vote of the players. If it were a vote of the players, Stingley might win it just because his style of play. You pointed this out before. Like, if you had a bunch of aspiring cornerbacks, you know, you had 10 aspiring cornerbacks and you told them, you can be Derek Stingley Jr. or you can be Sauce Gardner, I think 10 out of 10 would pick Derek Stingley based on the style of play, the hands, the body position. You know, Sauce Gardner is a physical linebacker. Stingley's a freak. You know, like, Stingley is an absolute freak. I'm with you. I think he finishes third on that thing. The other question I have, do you think Kamari Lassiter gets enough votes to where he shows up on the radar at cornerback?
No, I don't think so. I think that they'll, again, kind of like it is with Caleb from last year, that it's the complete season. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Lassiter was a guy that just improved a lot, just like Bullock, over the course of the season. He started off further ahead of Bullock. But I don't think he gets votes just yet.
Okay.
But people are waiting, and he's definitely on the radar.
I don't know. I don't know the exact number of people that are voting in this. Like, if it's 50 people, I'd say, yeah, Kamari Lassiter will get a few votes. If it's 10 people, then I'd be like, yeah, I don't know. You know, but it's the more people are voting, the more I feel like he'd get a few votes in this thing. He'll be on it next year. I don't know if it'll be in top 10, but if he has the same year he had as a rookie, Seth, with the, you know, adjusting for inflation, that there is going to be some improvement along with it, just general year two improvement, I think he starts to show up on things like this.
The thing I don't think he gets enough credit for is that he was a rookie cornerback playing opposite of Derek Stingley. And I don't, I like,
got targeted, like
that's,
man.
That's a perfect reason to target a rookie.
Yes.
And to go after him. That you've got, we're not going to mess around with Stingley. All right, he's over there. We're just going to figure out a way to scheme against Kamari Lassiter. And he led the NFL in completion rate allowed. So I think with Lassiter, there's two things. One, there's a wait and see element to it. Like, let's see him play the entire season the way he did in the second half of the season.
Yeah.
And then two, he's probably hurt a little bit just because the defense itself
mm-hmm.
was so opportunistic and had such a good pass rush, et cetera, that they're looking at him like the rich kid, you know? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. You had a lot of things going for you. I want to see if you can really get down in the muck and earn it on your own.
Yeah, you're a little entitled, Kamari Lassiter. Yeah, sure. So we'll see. So that's those get rolled out over the next week and a half by ESPN. I enjoy that. I enjoy those votes, those top tens. Joe Mixon made it for running backs, in case you're just tuning in.
I'm Natalie Morales of 48 Hours. So much of our reporting focuses on the stories of victims who didn't survive. But what about those who live to tell?
I survived a violent home invasion. There's no earthly reason why I'm alive.
From 48 Hours, this is It Could Have Been Me.
It makes you grateful for everything you have, you know.
You can follow and listen to It Could Have Been Me on Tuesdays in the 48 Hours podcast feed on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I don't enjoy PFF putting the Texans offensive line at 32. This guy whose name sounds like a superhero, Zoltan Boudet, wrote the article here, Seth.
I know we've definitely used his articles before.
Have we?
Because we dug in to figure out whether he was an actual human or not.
Or AI.
Because it sounded like this might be an AI creation
yeah.
or something.
Yeah.
Like, somebody went to ChatGPT or like, give me a catchy name that'll get people to click.
Okay, then you tell me. He ranks the offensive lines around the NFL 1 through 32. One, Philadelphia Eagles, all the way down. Houston Texans, 32.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you tell me if this feels like it's generated by a human being or AI. This is the analysis. This is the two-sentence paragraph. The presence of veterans Laremy Tunsil and Shaq Mason prevented an already shaky Texans offensive line from being even worse in 2024, and the team cut ties with both this offseason. Now there is very little to suggest that the group isn't deserving of the number 32 ranking ahead of the 2025 season.
Okay, so the thing that should catch your ear is, wait a second, you're citing Shaq Mason. Getting rid of Shaq Mason was, how on earth could you get rid of Shaq Mason?
Shaq Mason, according to possibly AI, was a stabilizing force on an otherwise trash offensive line.
This is where I got to go after old Zoltan here, because he's writing for PFF. And presumably using PFF grades to figure some of this out.
Yeah.
So Shaq Mason was a right guard. Lakin Tomlinson is a left guard. Yeah. But you bring Lakin Tomlinson in, you get rid of Shaq Mason.
Yep.
Shaq Mason by PFF grades. Mm-hmm. So this is a PFF writer. I'm going to go ahead and use the PFF grades.
Yep.
Shaq Mason was the 65th out of 138 graded guards. Lakin Tomlinson was 66th out of 138 graded guards.
Okay, so that's what we...
Yeah. I think the biggest difference between those two is, and this is what I try to tell people about Lakin Tomlinson, is like, I'd be very surprised if he comes in and gives you an all-pro season, but he's been incredibly durable.
Yeah.
And Shaq Mason has been beleaguered by injuries the last couple of years. And I think a lot of his really egregiously bad plays, I've been willing to say, you know what, he's probably struggling through a lot of stuff because he's been banged up. Lakin Tomlinson has missed one game in his entire NFL career.
Wow. In 10 years or so that he's played.
He's been
around a while, man. Yeah.
He's missed one game, and I didn't look into it to see whether it was, you know, the last game of a season or something like that. He's been incredibly durable.
Yeah.
So I think what they looked at is, we still want the veteran leadership. Shaq Mason looks like he might be aging poorly at this point. If we're going to bring in a guy that we know D'Amico has experience with and that we like, and that maybe you get the best out of him, but at the very least he's an intelligent veteran, then Lakin Tomlinson is more dependable and reliable physically than Shaq Mason.
Totally.
Was.
I could totally see that. When I saw that, somebody screen grabbed it and put it up on their Twitter feed, and I saw it. I'm like, I got to go look at these rankings and read some of this stuff that he's citing Shaq Mason preventing an already the words Shaq Mason preventing an already shaky Texans offensive line. I'm like, what are you talking? Shaq
Did
Mason
you
was
see Devondre Sweat throw Shaq Mason to the side like it was a cigarette butt?
When you were digging into the PFF grades just now, and I'm waiting for you to give them to me, I'm like, okay, like he's got to be in like the bottom 20. 65 out of 138 sounds high for me.
Yeah, that's a little bit. Those, you can't filter those rankings, or at least I can't figure out how to do it. That obvious, it's 138 guards, so that includes a lot of backups. So I don't know how many.
Yeah, that's
snaps
true.
That's true.
Yeah, you're right.
So there might be some guy who played 10 snaps and had a good run in his ranked.
So maybe. I guess you're right. Yeah, 65. There's 32 teams that each have two starting guards. That's 64.
Right.
Shaq Mason is 65. So yeah. There you go.
But 138 graded players.
Right. So, the Texans are 32. Where do they need to get?
No, I can't. I honestly had a hard time getting angry about this. If you try to put yourself objectively outside and you look at an offensive line that was really bad last year and you
traded
didn't do anything aggressive like the Vikings or the Bears did to bolster the talent other than drafting a rookie, and you can't count on a rookie. I like Arianta Ursary a lot as a prospect.
Well, he might not even start.
But he's still a rookie.
Yeah.
Right. So, no, I get it. It makes sense.
Yeah.
I think that most of it was really a combination of Bobby Slowick and Chris Strausser, the offensive line coach, really just not being competent in that scheme last year. So, but that's still another big if. Like, relying on a brand new offensive coordinator is the same as relying on a second round offensive tackle.
Yep.
You just don't know until you see it.
Yep.
So, I think that they're, objectively, I get why they did it.
Mm-hmm.
I just think looking at it more closely, there's a lot of reasons why. I think that this offensive line is very capable. If you take the guys that played last year, I think they're capable of being an average offensive line.
Yeah.
Like that, it's like just with better play calling and better coaching, really. Not the play calling, but the coaching. So that's where Nick Caley's challenge is. Like, if you're competent, this offensive line should look better than last year, no matter who the players are.
My only request with this offensive line, and it's not even what you think it might be. You might think it would be like, well, just keep C.J. Stroud protected. And that would be nice. You know, C.J.'s going to take his sacks. That's going to happen. I think what I'm about to request affects that, which is if this offensive line can just open up enough holes to where you're not in second and 12 all the time, or you're not in second and 10 all the time, or you're not in third and 14. Nobody was in more adverse down and distance situations in must-have-it downs on third down than C.J. Stroud was last year. If this offensive line can keep the offense on schedule, I think that inherently is going to take the sack total down from the 54 or whatever it was last year with C.J. Stroud, and you're going to be doing it in a way where Joe Mixon and Nick Chubb are going to be moving the football 4 or 5 yards. I'm not expecting them to be breakaway guys anymore. But, man, just stay in second and 4 and second and 3, and I think you've got the quarterback and you've got the weapons to be able to have a really good offense if you just stay out of those bad situations. You know what else puts you in those situations? Penalties. So, getting rid of Tunsil automatically. I saw a stat set, Seth, that had the numbers 1 through 32 offenses in terms of offensive penalty yards, overall offensive penalty, not just the line. If you take Laremy Tunsil's penalty yards out of the Texans number, they go from like 19th, among the worst, to like the third best. If you take Laremy Tunsil's penalty, and I know whoever replaces him is going to have a few false starts. I get that.
Yeah.
They're not going to have 17 of them like Laremy did or whatever it was, you know?
That was one of Belichick's big points in his book, was the acceptability of various penalties. And he said anything pre-snap is just flat out unacceptable.
Yep.
It's just, that's a mental error. It's preventable. It's unacceptable. It's selfish. You're just not. Yeah. So I'm guessing Bill Belichick, if he were one of the people polled on ranking the offensive tackles, he's one of the guys that's definitely going to look at the pre-snap penalties as way worse and more weighted than other people. But it is all of the problem with Laremy Tunsil's pre-snap penalties wasn't just the damage they do in that moment. It's that they were selfish penalties. Yeah. It was him specifically trying to get a jump on the snap and doing it, like pushing the envelope selfishly in a way that other young guys are looking at and seeing like, well, I guess that's the way you operate if you're a stud NFL offensive tackle.
That's a big point of contention, I think, that I've seen with the Laremy stands that you were talking about before. The people that, I feel like there's a big like overlap with the Jalen Green stands and the Laremy Tunsil stands on social media, like they, like that stick up for them. That's a big one that I've seen when you label the false starts as selfish. Like, they're not selfish. They're just penalties. They're, you know, it's a mistake. Yeah. It's not selfish. It's like, no, that's Laremy trying to game the PFF system is what he's doing right
there. Right.
It's
a, if you had a defensive lineman,
he gets paid on that.
Perpetually jumping off sides, like to an extreme degree. Mm-hmm. Like, no, that's just being selfish. You're just, you're being bad at it. You're trying to push the envelope and you're going too far. Why? Because you're selfish.
Yep.
With the offensive, so when we talk about the importance of the offensive coordinator, I think one of the big, the last couple of years, CJ has been one of the slowest to get rid of the football. Mm-hmm. And when you look at players who have a long time to throw, or who have their time to throw is the longest, it generally falls into two different categories. Well, three different categories. One would be the guys who are super athletic and extend plays.
Yeah.
And also use a lot of play action. Lamar Jackson, you know, Jalen Hurts. Those guys are the two slowest to throw. They do just fine with it.
Yep.
Then you guys got like, then you got a bunch of guys who are in the Kubiak Shanahan model, where you're lining up and using tight ends and play action and deep drops at times, like all that stuff. So Sam Darnold is up there. But that offense was being executed properly. Brock Purdy, one of the slowest to throw. But that offense, over the course of the last 3 years, has been executed properly.
Yeah.
CJ's a guy who's not an athlete like Lamar Jackson or Jalen Hurts is, but he's in this Kubiak Shanahan system, and they're trying to run the ball, set up play action, all this stuff. And it was being executed so poorly that, yeah, that put CJ in a really bad position. There were times last year where, no, they should have been in the spread it out and get rid of the ball quickly more often. The offensive line wouldn't have looked as bad if you were in that mode more often. But CJ, there were so many times where CJ was in positions where he was ready psychologically to get rid of the ball. There was nobody in the route tree that was there for him.
Yeah.
You know, it was just Bobby did a really bad job of giving him the easy options.
Yep.
The way that the Commanders did a great job of giving Jaden Daniels easy options early in the down.
That's where I go back to that Hutchinson clip we played yesterday, that Xavier Hutchinson clip, and that sounds like what he's alluding to when he says guys are going to be in the right spots, they're going to be in the right places to make the right plays, that kind of thing. Like that's when you describe what CJ's going through. That's what I think back to yesterday and playing that clip. Maybe we'll play it later in the show from Xavier Hutchinson, where he talks about confidence and being in the right place. It just seemed like guys didn't know what they were doing last year.
The third category of guys who throw the ball slowly, just dumb players. Yeah. Guys that just hold on to the ball way too long. Or rookies. Yeah.
Kenny Pickett. I don't even know if he's on there. I just felt like picking on him. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. That was fun going through that stuff right there. A little football. A couple weeks, 2 weeks away from Texans training camp. Looking forward to that. All right, Travis Kelce has ideas on how to shut down the next big thing in the NFL. And am I being a little too, the opposite of cheap? There's a lot of people that think this one thing with the NFL is expensive. I don't know. I don't get that's the price tag on it. I'm not as upset about, but I don't want to order it, so maybe I'm not the right guy. We'll tell you what that is coming up next.
I'm Natalie Morales of 48 Hours. So much of our reporting focuses on the stories of victims who didn't survive. But what about those who live to tell?
I survived a violent home invasion. There's no earthly reason why I'm alive.
From 48 Hours, this is It Could Have Been Me.
It makes you grateful for everything you have, you know.
You can follow and listen to It Could Have Been Me on Tuesdays in the 48 Hours podcast feed on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I definitely think that of the non-Texans thing, Seth, that intrigued me going into training camp, and this isn't even a total non-Texan thing because this guy's going to be in their division for the next several years, watching the Travis Hunter both sides of the ball thing and how that gets handled, both in terms of the workload and the reps in training camp, and then obviously how it gets executed in the regular season. You know, is there one side of the ball they lean to more than another? Is it just they're going to do what Colorado did and just play him on both sides? I am super intrigued by it, especially because the GM, and to a different extent the head coach, but the GM, Gladstone, the magical Gladstone, has touted Travis Hunter as this revolutionary force that's going to somehow change the game of football.
Yeah, the GM, I appreciate that D'Amico's approach to C.J. Stroud and Will Anderson in their rookie years was in the press conference right from the very beginning, him saying, hey, my job is to take pressure off these guys. There's already a lot of natural pressure from A, the player himself. Yeah. If they're the right kind of guy, they're trying to live up to expectations. B, the outside world has expectations. So his job as a coach is to maybe just, hey, throttle it back a little bit. You're playing football. Let's not make this more than it is.
Yep.
Gladstone comes out and in front of Travis Hunter promises the greatest show the world has ever seen. And talking about him as a guy, he's talking about him as a guy who maybe had already played in the NFL or something.
Yes.
Because of how he defies expectations. Yeah. That I know, I think the organization, the way the Jaguars have operated, the way they treated OTAs, is that they plan on him playing a boatload of snaps on both sides of the ball right off the bat.
Yep.
Which is an interesting and bold strategy. But man, that puts a whole on a guy who's a tinier guy, by the way.
Yeah.
Who's gonna be learning how to play NFL football. The one thing you can't do in the NFL as a defensive back is kind of cruise when you're in zone coverage, and especially when you're playing zone versus a college kid who might not have it. He's going to throw the ball to the first read and is just not probably going to challenge you all that much. It's a whole lot different when you're being asked to play man versus Nico Collins,
dude,
you know, and then go back and then go play offense immediately afterwards.
Yeah, go play off. I mean, yeah, think about. Especially, like, I think of Nico. Thinking about chasing Nico around on the scramble drill when CJ starts rolling out. And Nico has this greatest knack of finding the exact spot he needs to be when the play breaks down. And you're Travis Hunter in a blender trying to keep up with him.
It is 100%. Like, without taking anything away from what Shohei Ohtani has been able to accomplish, physically, it's monumentally harder.
Yeah.
I think Travis Hunter got some crap for saying that it was harder what he was doing than Shohei or something. I tend to agree with him.
Yeah.
Just physically, it's more grueling.
Yep.
I understand the challenges of the Shohei Ohtani. That's physically grueling as well. And he's already, broken down. The Tommy John's no big deal anymore, but we'll see how long it lasts. With Travis Hunter, I'd have to go back and look and see the last time a guy played average more than 100 snaps a game in the NFL, because I'm guessing it was in the 1960s or so.
Yeah.
Whenever they got rid of, whenever they started platooning players.
That's right.
But maybe in the 1940s.
Here was Travis Kelce, Kansas City tight end. He was
on average more than 100 snaps.
Yeah.
Guys that have done it more than, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Travis Kelce was on the Bussin' with the Boys podcast, Taylor Lewan and Will Compton. And they got talking about Travis Hunter. Here's what Travis Kelce thinks that NFL teams are going to do to try to wear Travis Hunter out.
Teams are going to be going after him.
Right. And
they're going to try and make his day. Yeah, they're going to try and make his day miserable.
Right. And he's got to go play wide receiver and then turn around and basically be like high school where you just stand on the field the whole time.
Yeah.
And just wait for the game to be over.
Dude, if he plays corner, they're going to run deep balls at him all day. They're going to run the wide receivers just take off on him all day just to try and get him tired.
Yeah.
I'm like, why wouldn't you just attack him that way?
So, I mean, they're basically what he's saying there. It sounds like to me, Seth, like make him run wind sprints.
No, it is. And it's true. That's one of the worst things about playing cornerback is in the NFL is that, Nico Collins comes out, runs a go route, then he goes and takes a blow on the sideline while a fresh-legged dude comes in and runs a go route.
Yep.
Yeah. Like, it sucks. They have to keep going and going and going. But then those defensive backs, 100% of them get to go take a blow on the sideline after that series is over.
He's got to go
Travis
play
Hunter's
wide receiver.
Travis Hunter's going to be over on the off. Not to mention, and at the same time, and this is a difference too between Shohei Ohtani and an NFL player. So normally a defensive back, if you're having some troubles early in the game, what do you do when you go to the sideline? You're looking at the iPad. You're talking about adjustments and everything. Nope, not for your rookie cornerback. He's going to be playing offense while you're also trying to fix what's going on defense.
Yep.
And I'm not saying it's impossible, but I don't think people really appreciate how difficult this is going to be for him if the Jaguars choose to handle it like that. The other part, too, is you could either run go routes or if I'm an offensive coordinator, I'm watching and I'm going to see how they're playing. And if the Jags are playing a bunch of man, crossing routes all day long.
Yeah.
Because that's what the Patriots did to the Falcons. And why they were able to come back in the Super Bowl is the Falcons were playing really aggressively on defense and manning everybody up. So the Patriots just ran all over the field horizontally the first three quarters, and the defensive backs were gassed by the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just get them running. It's the same as when a good outside zone running team clicks in the fourth quarter, a lot of times it's because the front seven defensive players have had to run sideline to sideline the whole game, and their legs are just gassed by the fourth quarter.
It's an interesting point. Yeah, that the crossers, and combining that with what Kelsey was just saying, Kelsey sounds like he's talking about go routes and deep routes, yeah. But it's running.
I like the crossers, just, yeah, getting them running regardless.
Yeah, getting them running.
If you go out and do nothing but go routes, you could be limiting yourself offensively too, but just, yeah, get them running as much as possible.
And that's the thing for me with Travis Hunter, Seth, and is he going to make it playing both ways? Is he going to be able to do this? I err more towards the side of what you brought up earlier, just he's not a big dude. He's a few hits away from maybe having the will to do that taken out of him in the NFL on one side of the ball. It had never dawned on me about what you're talking about with the crossers and what Kelsey's talking about. The cardio part of it never dawned on me as the thing that would ultimately do him in. I always thought it would be the head-to-toe physical toll of the blunt force trauma part of it more so. But now it's going to be both.
Dude, I was a hustle guy, but when I was in high school, I mean, like, that's how I made my living. I was a hustle guy in the NFL and in college.
Yep.
In high school, when I played every single snap of a football game, including special teams, like, I was on the field the entire 48 minutes of a football game.
Yeah.
Like, there's times where you physiologically, you kind of cruise a little
you
bit.
Have to.
Like, you can't play with the same level of tenacity that you can when you're platooning.
Yeah.
And that's the part I wonder about with him. Yes, is he more capable of doing it than other people? Sure, probably. But I don't know if it's possible to play at that high level on both sides of the ball over 100 snaps per game. And the mental side, and not to mention the mental side of it.
Yeah. Are you as intrigued by this as I am in terms of a topic going in, like, of something to watch non-Texans going into the season, this thing with Travis Hunter?
I'm
engrossed by it. I think it's going to be really interesting.
If he pulls it up, and everything I'm saying right now, I will be 100% transparent about it. If he pulls it off and does it, then everything I'm saying right now is proof of just how impressive it will be.
Correct.
Because there's so many barriers to it, and there's reasons why nobody else has ever done it before.
Yeah.
But I'm just fascinated by the fact that the Jaguars seem to think the ones that they're the smart ones. Remember, the old rule, if you're trying to do something that nobody else does, you're either a genius or you're an idiot. And the odds are right now that the Jaguars are being idiots.
Well, their history would tell us that they're idiots.
Look, Daryl Morey did a bunch of things that nobody else was doing. And you know what? I mean, it didn't ultimately work out, but he was a genius in that regard.
Yep.
Bill O'Brien tried to do a lot of things that conventional wisdom said were stupid. You know what? Yeah, it was stupid. It was really, really dumb.
It was dumb.
As a GM. Fine as a head coach. Yep. GM, that's what I'm talking about.
All right, the other thing I teased into this segment, I think it works in the Pettycast. So I'm going to carry it over to that. We got a pretty good Pettycast. Here we got a very baseball centric, you know, now that basketball season is over, we've got a good petty cast for you. We get petty every Tuesday at 8 a.m. Text in your 713-572-4610. The pettiest things we've been hearing all week long, we will get to coming up next.
I'm Natalie Morales of 48 Hours. So much of our reporting focuses on the stories of victims who didn't survive. But what about those who live to tell?
I survived a violent home invasion. There's no earthly reason why I'm alive.
From 48 Hours, this is It Could Have Been Me.
It makes you grateful for everything you have, you know.
You can follow and listen to It Could Have Been Me on Tuesdays in the 48 Hours podcast feed on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.